It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio this morning, or at least three quarters live in the studio this morning, Maria Tomchick, co-editor at Eat the State. How are you this morning?
Good.
All right.
I'm here.
You are here. Job's not here.
Job's not here. He has the flu.
He's got the flu or something like that.
Something like that.
He didn't sound very good when I just talked to him on the phone.
Yeah, I either had a really bad migraine attack yesterday or I had the flu.
Okay.
Because I've got some lingering stuff this morning, but at least I'm here today. And
you are, and I appreciate
that.
And I also appreciate that you're about 10 feet away from me. So let's speaking of the flu. This is somewhat related. I had a couple of headlines that I just wanted to share very very quickly with you and people. Mm-hmm. I saw in the British Independent publication that you can get online last Sunday. They had a headline about that a worldwide VP of genetics for the British pharmaceutical mega corporation GlaxoSmithKline says that half of their pharmaceuticals are not effective. In fact, the actual quote is that he gave, the vast majority of drugs, more than 90%, only work on 30 to 50% of the people.
Yeah.
That's quite... This is after our local federal government just, you know, bent over backwards, giving sweetheart deals to the pharmaceutical companies.
Pharmaceutical companies, yes, that's true.
Bravo. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, and the other one that I thought was kind of shocking was, for several reasons, Boeing pledges to cooperate with feds. Now, you would think that, you know, that would be, well, I mean, I know I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not naive, but you would hope that corporations would want to cooperate with any, you know, municipality at whatever level.
The assumption, of course, is that they don't. And
exactly.
Of course, most of them don't. But Boeing, in this case, really has to, because most of their growth at this point is not coming from the commercial airplane division. It's coming from their defense contracts. And if they don't cooperate at least some, they're going to lose those defense contracts, and that's going to be very, very bad for them.
So I would like to propose across-the-board revision for all corporate charters that if they don't cooperate with any investigations levied by whatever level of community wants to do it, that their charter is revoked, and then we just grandfather that into all corporate charters.
Well, that'd be nice, Mike, except that'd put a lot of people out of business, particularly high-paid, high-powered corporate attorneys who make their living off of fighting off these Fed audits and investigations and so forth.
Well, that's okay. We could find them new jobs with like at Walmart. So let's jump into what we actually had planned, as opposed to my ramblings. This week there were several developments here locally. One is the Seattle City Council has a new president.
Oh yes, the new president of the Seattle City Council is Jan Drago. Naturally, it would be someone that Greg Nichols can get along with. She's also going to lead a new committee on government relations, which is so far ill-defined. Nobody quite knows what that new committee is going to be doing. What's really disturbing are some of the other committee assignments. For example, Gene Godden is going to be the head of the committee that oversees Seattle City Light. When you put that together with the candidate that Greg Nichols has proposed to head Seattle City Light, a man who has absolutely no experience with electrical utilities, his experience is almost exclusively in running water utilities, then that's going to be a pretty dangerous combination, I think. Two people kind of floundering in the dark there. Now, some of the other committee assignments are interesting, too. Peter Steinbrück has the Land Use and Planning Committee, which could be kind of interesting, considering all the development stuff Greg Nichols has been putting in front of the Seattle City Council. Tom Rasmussen's going to be head of the Housing, Human Services, and Health Committee. It'll be interesting to see how he performs for low-income housing advocates here in the city. Richard McIver's going to be head of Finance and Budget. Nick Licata, fortunately, is going to be head of the Public Safety Committee. I think
that can only improve things.
Yeah, I think we can celebrate that. David Della is going to get the Parks and Neighborhoods Committee, Nick Licata's old stomping grounds. And then Jim Compton will have the Seattle Public Utilities.
I wonder if David Della is going to be doing poetry readings prior to all his meetings like Nick Licata did.
I don't know. We'll see if he continues that. But anyway, so that's part of what I was going to talk about with the city council.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other part I wanted to talk about, too, is folks probably know by now that the South Lake Union plans have gone through, that I believe it's city land use code has been some of the land use code restrictions have been waived for the South Lake Union area so that Paul Allen's Vulcan Ventures can go ahead and start building buildings with higher ceilings in order to house biotech companies. Now, Nichols had also put into the city budget, which I think is still being approved, plans to set aside some city money to develop the South Lake Union area as well, including money for a South Lake Union streetcar. Now, a lot of attention has been paid to that, but not as much attention paid to the Northgate development plan. And just this past week, the Northgate plan went through the city council. Now, Nichols had proposed a plan for Northgate that pretty much gave the Simon Property Group everything that it wanted. The Simon Property Group wants to expand Northgate Mall and add a lot more retail without making any changes to the sort of endless sea of concrete that you see up there at Northgate Mall. Now, neighborhood activists had wanted to daylight Thornton Creek, which runs underneath the South Mall parking lot, and they had asked for other improvements as well, like a community center, a library, maybe some open space so that it wouldn't just be a sea of cars. Now, what happened was the city council had proposed a plan that was more in line with the neighborhood groups, and Nichols had proposed a plan that was in line with what the developers wanted. And what passed the city council was generally a plan that gave Simon Property Group everything it wanted and a couple of hazy promises to the neighborhood groups. The plan that passed repeals the general development plan for Northgate. So you have to understand there was a plan, a neighborhood plan already in place for what would be required if Simon Property Group wanted to redevelop Northgate. And the developer, Simon Property Group, said, well, we don't like this because it's not economically feasible. And so they had lobbied hard to get that general development plan put in place by the neighborhood groups and the city to be repealed, and they essentially got exactly what they wanted. Now, it also has a couple of little bones thrown to the neighborhood groups. One is that the city has a 1-year option to buy about 3 acres just across from the mall in order to provide a little natural drainage and open space. Now, that's just an option in the next year to buy. It's not a promise that, yes, you are actually going to get some open space in this whole process. It's only maybe we'll get it for you if we've got the money and we keep on top of it. And then it provides a possible environmental impact action plan. Now, the neighborhood groups had said, well, if we don't get some of these amenities that we want, at least let's have an environmental impact statement, some kind of environmental impact process here. Well, they didn't really even get a definite yes on that. They only got the possibility of an environmental impact plan.
And that's what they were asking for as well in the South Lake Union.
Exactly.
Move was an environmental impact statement.
And they haven't gotten a promise on that either.
Well, no, they just went right around it.
Yeah, and so what this does is these two development projects, the South Lake Union area and the Northgate plan, have pretty much set a really bad precedent for neighborhood groups and their ability to control what actually goes on in their own neighborhoods. It's pretty much dumped aside in the Northgate area, at least dumped aside a plan that was already put in place in favor of a developer. And in South Lake Union, just pretty much run roughshod over local groups. That's what we didn't quite expect when we voted for Greg Nichols, but it's what we got. And folks should keep that in mind when he's up for re-election.
Mm. All right. Well, let's jump to the international this week in Iraq.
Get ready for the biggest one night event. About to hit the town.
This week in Iraq.
I was wondering when you were going to bring that back.
I just remembered we still had that.
Anyway, so I have a lot of stuff on Iraq this week. which is why we're cutting to it pretty quickly. First off on my list is there was new information leaked to the press this week on Israel helping U.S. troops in Iraq. Both Israeli sources and the U.S. military planners have confirmed that U.S. military officers have studied Israeli tactics in the occupied territories and are now using these same failed tactics in Iraq. Now, just as a little reminder for our listeners, some of those tactics include surrounding several villages in Iraq with razor wire and forcing the occupants to pass through a single checkpoint to come and go. Now, at the checkpoints, Iraqis, particularly male Iraqis between the age of 18 and 65, have to show an ID card issued by the U.S. military and printed only in English. Some of the other tactics that are being deployed in Iraq include destroying buildings suspected of being guerrilla hideouts, bulldozing the homes of suspected guerrillas and their family members, arresting the relatives of suspected guerrillas and or people who may have information about the guerrillas. Now, Iraqi human rights groups have accused the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. troops, of holding 18,000 such people in indefinite detention inside Iraq. I just want to read a quote from one of the officers in charge of surrounding a village in Iraq with razor wire. This is from Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Sassaman. He said this week, quote, "With a heavy dose of fear and violence and a lot of money for projects, I think we can convince these people we are here to help them." Now, I want to talk about one of the heavy doses of fear and violence that the U.S. military is bringing to Iraq. It's the new Task Force 121, a U.S. counterinsurgency operation whose main duty will be to assassinate suspected guerrilla leaders. These guys are being trained at Fort Bragg by members of the Israeli Defense Forces. A former senior U.S. intelligence official told The Guardian of London, quote, "This is basically an assassination program. This is a hunter-killer team." The Guardian also noted that U.S. Special Forces teams are already operating inside Syria in an attempt to kill foreign jihadists before they cross the border, which of course brings up the question of who's a jihadist and how do you define that? And how do you know they're going to cross the border? Seems to be a pretty interesting question to me. And, of course, isn't it illegal to assassinate people under international law?
This seems fairly similar to a program they ran in Vietnam called the Phoenix Program.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
As well as when they were doing going into Cambodia and Laos and killing people there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also very similar to Israeli tactics in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, where they go in and just assassinate people who they think might be the head of militant groups and anyone around them or associated with them or who happens to be in the same car or whatever. Now, even worse, one of the planners behind Task Force 121 is a man named Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin. Folks might remember who Boykin is. He recently told a church congregation in Oregon that the U.S. was at war with Satan and that these Iraqi guerrillas, quote, "want to destroy us as a Christian army," end quote. These are the kind of folks who are running this assassination program.
And he said something about Bush being appointed by God.
Oh, yes.
That's the guy in charge. That's good.
That's the guy in charge one of the guys in charge of this Task Force 121. Now, how are things going in Iraq? Because I know part of the plan there is not just to have U.S. troops, but to have those U.S. troops replaced by Iraqi troops. Well, this week, we finally learned that about half of the newly trained recruits for the Iraqi army have resigned their posts. The first 700-man battalion has lost about 300 men in recent weeks, some of them complaining about the low pay of $60 per month. Now, another reason may be because of the tactics that the U.S. military would like these guys to employ, given that they're using the same kind of tactics against Iraqi civilians that are being used by the Israeli military against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And, of course, there's no knowing exactly how many of these 300 men who have resigned from the new Iraqi army are actually going to join up with the guerrillas. Now, the U.S. goal is to train about 40,000 new Iraqi troops by next October. If this is any sign of how that whole process is gonna play out, then that 40,000 goal seems to be pretty difficult to reach, I would say.
So 40,000 by next October?
By next October.
Okay. Because yeah. I just saw an article again in today's Independent saying that an envoy to Tony Blair was saying forces will be out by next July. Which I found kind of
that is interesting, and I think that's
like
very unrealistic.
Astrologers and meteorologists to predict what we're going to be doing in Iraq.
So anyway, now another item on my list this week is the French press agency has been doing something in the past week or two that the American press has not been able to do either because they have not wanted to do it or because they're afraid they'll be killed if they try it. The French press agency has been interviewing a number of guerrilla fighters in Iraq to get a broad picture of who the guerrillas really are and what their goals are. Now they are able to break down the guerrilla fighters into three main groups. The first group are supporters of Saddam Hussein, who comprise mostly former Ba'ath Party members and members of the former Iraqi secret services and the Fedayeen and other militias. And those guys are fighting to restore Saddam. And the French press agency reporters say that they seem to be the best armed and the most coordinated. Now, the second group are Islamists, local Islamists, not foreign fighters. These guys recruit in the mosques, and they occasionally coordinate with the Saddam supporters because they can get weapons that way. Also, because Saddam is a head of state in their eyes, and he has called for a jihad that makes him a fellow traveler. Now, these guys are fighting against the infidels that are occupying Iraq and in charge of some of the holy places in Iraq. So that's the second group. The third group are nationalists, which include anti-Saddam Ba'ath Party members, former military men, and nationalists and pan-Arab supporters. Now, these folks refuse to work with the supporters of Saddam, but they occasionally coordinate with the Islamists on a local level. So, as you can see, these three groups kind of interlock. And the third group, the nationalists, are actually fighting a war of liberation. So you've got three different groups that kind of interlock and coordinate with each other, which is why the resistance, these guerrilla fighters, are beginning to look more organized. And they're fighting for three different reasons. So, and this is something that kind of has come through the U.S. press reports of who the guerrillas are, if you really read them closely and you ignore the continuous stress and the continuous emphasis on these are foreign terrorists, which is what the Bush administration would have us believe. Now, the French press agency reporters asked these guys over and over again, how many foreign fighters do you have in your ranks? And they didn't deny that they had a few foreign fighters, but they really said that they're not a sizable contingent. So all three groups have a few foreign fighters, but they said they're not a sizable contingent, maybe a handful. So that's kind of interesting that actually somebody out there wants to know what is going on. And there is some place where you can find that information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another topic on my list, the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, that's the U.S. troops and the British troops, etc., have put pressure on the Iraqi health ministry to stop its official count of Iraqi civilian casualties from the war. Now, the health ministry had decided in July that it would send out letters to all of the hospitals and clinics in Iraq to get a good idea of how many Iraqi civilians died because of the war. Now, they realized that the counts were not going to be absolutely accurate because some of the records were destroyed or some hospitals were unable to keep records because of the vast influx of patients that needed to be treated. Yet they thought that they would get enough responses to get a good estimate. And in fact, they were getting a lot of good information from hospitals all over the country and were ready to put together a report and an estimate of how many Iraqi civilians had died. And what happened was the Coalition Provisional Authority, Paul Bremer, basically told them, you've got to stop that. You can't do that. This is a particularly bad thing because most Iraqis actually believe that the health ministry is, well, actually, most Iraqis actually expect the health ministry to be part of an Iraqi government, something that represents the Iraqi people, not the Coalition Provisional Authority. So to have Paul Bremer say, look, to tell an Iraqi health ministry, to tell a ministry official, look, you have to stop doing something, has really pointed up to Iraqi civilians and citizens that the government is not independent of the U.S.
Well, and as well, that the U.S. really doesn't care at all about the real numbers of dead Iraqis.
Yeah, we know that already. But coming out with a real figure is something that the U.S. fears in this case. Now, also in the news this week, Halliburton, Dick Cheney's firm, he was CEO of Halliburton from 1995 to 2000, has had its hand slapped by the Pentagon, whose auditors found that Halliburton had overcharged the Army $61 million for gasoline in Iraq. Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root has had a no-bid contract for as much as $15.6 billion for rebuilding Iraq's oil infrastructure, and they also have an open-ended, unlimited contract for providing services to U.S. troops in Iraq, and that's what this gasoline purchase falls under, is that open-ended, unlimited contract. $5 billion has already been paid to Halliburton for these two contracts, and it's expected to go much, much higher. Now, Halliburton is charging more than double what other contractors are charging in order to import gasoline in Iraq, and while Halliburton claims it's not pocketing the difference, I think that a real formal audit would find that they are. Now, you might ask, why does the U.S. need to import gas from Kuwait into Iraq? Doesn't Iraq have the second largest oil reserves in the world? Well, yeah, that's true. But the problem is in getting it out of the ground, refining it, and transporting it to fuel stations and fuel depots. Now, we've talked on this program in the past about pipeline bombings, and there was another one again this week. They've been happening at least one or two a week ever since the so-called end of the war in May. Another pipeline was bombed, I believe this one between the Baiji refinery and the Al Dura refinery near Baghdad. And what people don't read about in the U.S. press is that there's not enough fuel to run the refineries, so the refineries are only operating at a fraction of their capacity in Iraq. There's also not enough fuel to keep the Iraqi population supplied. There are growing lines at gas stations, particularly in and around Baghdad, and that's starting to lead to some unrest, and that even Baghdad itself had to suffer routine shortages and blackouts because of the lack of fuel. That's going to continue and is going to be a major problem. So that's the major reason why U.S. forces have to import gasoline from Kuwait into the country.
There was a fairly large uproar this week as well, in addition to Halliburton taking a little heat. It's hard to call that heat. with other corporations that were pretty upset with the exclusive contracts that...
Oh, yes. One more thing I want to talk about in regards to Halliburton is that the Bush administration has been saying that they're going to take these no-bid contracts with Halliburton, and they are going to bid them out so that other companies can compete. Now, they've pushed back the deadline to do that several times. First, they were going to do that in September, then they pushed it back to October, and then in October, they pushed it back to early December, and now they've pushed it back again to mid-December. Now, they're saying not until January or February. So now, while they keep pushing back the bidding on these contracts, Halliburton is raking in the dough. So it's clearly a favoritism issue that Halliburton is getting paid enormous amounts of money to do this work under these no-bid contracts, and the Bush administration is simply stalling in order to make it, and it makes it even harder for other companies to come in and place a reasonable bid when they haven't got a clue what Halliburton has done and hasn't done, what the actual cost should be versus the inflated costs Halliburton is charging, et cetera, et cetera. And many companies have simply said, well, thrown up their hands and said, well, if we don't have a good deadline for when we need to put together a bid, and we don't know what the security situation is going to be, and Halliburton's already on the ground doing the bulk of the work, there's no way we're going to put together a bid. So it's actually sabotaging the whole bid process by pushing it back and pushing it back and pushing it back. Now, it's true that other companies have been in an uproar, too, over another thing that was released this week. Paul Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon, issued a directive, I believe it was last Friday, but it only became public this week. And this directive bans companies from France, Germany, Russia, and Canada, among a few other nations, from bidding on reconstruction contracts in Iraq. Now, this is pretty much direct punishment for these countries for not having supported the U.S. military invasion of Iraq. And it also brings up the issue of, I don't know, what would you call it, bribery or blackmail, since the directive that Wolfowitz issued links this whole act to the U.S.'s need for these nations to provide troops for Iraq, saying, quote, every effort must be made to expand international cooperation in Iraq, end quote. That's a pretty direct call for send us some of your bodies, you know, and we'll send you some of our business, which I think could really be a definition of compassionate conservatism, right? Exchanging some dead bodies for benefits for business.
Well, maybe countries like Canada and Germany could send them some of their dead bodies from Afghanistan, where they've been getting killed.
Or the Congo, or various other conflicts around the world where the U.S. won't send, where we won't send our troops. Of course, we don't get directives issued by the European Union. Look, you can't bid on reconstruction in Afghanistan or Congo or any of these other places because you didn't send us any of your troops. Now, this Machiavellianism can really backfire, and it is starting to. Now, the Bush administration needs France, Germany, and particularly Russia to forgive Iraq's pre-war debts before the IMF and the World Bank can release a large portion of the funds that are going to go for reconstruction in Iraq. Now, most of those funds are structured as loans from the IMF and the World Bank. It amounts to billions and billions of dollars. And first, they have to do something to. They have to figure out what to do with Iraq's pre-war debt. Russia holds the bulk of it, holds about $8 billion. And Russian President Vladimir Putin basically said this week, well, sorry, but we're not going to. We don't want to reschedule that debt. We're not going to play the game if you're not going to let us bid on reconstruction projects in Iraq. So the Bush administration is scrambling to try to clean up that problem.
Whereas before, they were sounding like they were ready to reschedule that debt.
Oh yeah, they were sounding like they were ready to at least talk terms. And now they're saying, no, we're not even going to talk terms because you slapped us in the face.
All right. Anything else on Iraq?
Nope. That's it.
Very quickly, also related to all this last week, I think it was just after we'd done the radio show, there was an article that came out about multiple articles about the U.S. Killing in Afghanistan, firing on what they said was a terrorist.
A terrorist, and ending up killing 9 children.
So,
yeah, and an adult that they now assume is not the person they were targeting. So, yeah, that's actually becoming more and more common in Afghanistan now. An interesting report this just in the last day or two, the UN, which is in charge of registering people in Afghanistan for the upcoming elections there, is saying now that they are, because of the bad security situation in Afghanistan, because of the resurgent Taliban, they're saying that they're considering withdrawing from the country, which would mean putting an end to the registration for the upcoming elections, which is a serious problem. If the UN's not going to do it, who has the ability and the will to do it? Because the United States is not, has said that that's not what they want to do in Afghanistan. And in fact, the U.S. isn't even doing what they said they want to do, which is trying to suppress the Taliban. The Taliban is actually growing stronger at this point.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And tell us, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around the Puget Sound area. If you want to find us online, we're at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to complain about anything you hear on the show, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461. And I want to thank all the listeners for being patient this week. I haven't made a lot of sense when I was talking because I have not been feeling well, but hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I did.